Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. November 20th, 2020. Eye to eye, no need for words. Comment: humanity is divided into those who wear masks and those who do not. We are interested in those who wear masks. Psychologists say that if a newborn child grows up and sees mother and father in masks all the time, that is, the lower part of their faces are covered all the time, and the child hears sounds, does not see the lips, and sees only the eyes, then he may develop abilities that are still unknown to humanity. My response: yes. He will have to make up for what he does not see in his mother and father. However, this is not normal, because this is not in our nature. Our nature is when mother kisses, mother hugs, mother whispers, and the child grabs mother's lips and mouth. Question: does something change in the mother and father when they cover part of their face and communicate with the child? Answer: of course. To be unable to touch the baby with your lips. Lips are everything. Lips are the most important part of the mother. This is the organ of communication where sounds and warmth come from. Question: are we now depriving the child of this warmth? Answer: of course. What can we do if we are such egoists, if we pass on the egoism gene to each other? Question: but mother should not take off her mask yet? Answer: obviously. After all, a mother is in contact with many other people, and therefore can bring anything to her child. Comment: psychologists say that anxiety and fatigue in society is also caused by restriction in communication, since masks cover most of the face and we do not see others smiling. My response: this is also true. But it serves you right, since you oppose each other so much. It is right that you see half a face that does not express anything. It was a false smile, and therefore it disappeared. The coronavirus took it away. Now, if you want to see another person's face, you have to see the correct face that matches their correct intention. If you do this, you will receive faces without masks. Question: will the smile come back when we begin smiling to each other internally? Answer: yes, of course. Comment: psychologists say that we were ready for word-of-mouth communication and not ready for eye-to-eye communication, not ready for this reality. My response: that's right. It is because our mouths speak such nonsense, such lies. Look at all these politicians, at anyone at all. Better to be silent and close their mouths. And the eyes may be harder to hide. Eyes are connected to deeper layers of the soul. Question: what is eye to eye? What can one hide here? Answer: this is a deeper contact. Question: what qualities will develop in us, after wearing masks? What do you think? Answer: we will become more sensitive to each other. We will start looking at each other more closely. We will start talking less. We will begin to give more importance to words, to actions, to the fact that we are allowed to be in contact with each other. Question: will our every word be thought over? Answer: yes. From CAB TV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, November 2nd, 2020. Spiritual growth is impossible without joy. We are in the world of infinity, full of light, which fills the entire universe. But we feel this world as empty, that gives us nothing but a tiny spark of life so that we can somehow exist. Therefore, we do not value this world. Everything in it is hidden, but we need to reveal it. Concealment and disclosure depend only on us, and no one else. I just have to convince myself that I already exist in the world of infinity, in the ocean of infinite light, infinite fulfillment, and I have no shortage of anything. The only thing that I am lacking is my correct attitude. If I relate to the world this way, I will find that it is all there. This means that I rise to faith above reason, thanks to a sense of joy, unity, and mutual support. This is how we discover the world of absolute goodness and see that nothing has really changed except our perception. Previously, I saw the whole world as black because I judged it according to my shortcomings. And when I correct my attitude to the world, rise to faith above reason, and want to see a good world full of the upper light, the Creator, I see that this is what it really is. And this is not a psychological suggestion or self-deception but a true reality. I only need to raise myself from the degree of Malkut to the degree of Bina in order to see the world in the quality of bestowal and not receiving. Then the world will be good, and I will see that everything is fine in it and there is no evil. It is simply that everyone judges to the extent of their own corruption. If there is evil inside me, then I see evil around me. And if I correct myself, I see the world corrected. It all depends on my inner view. And the most correct attitude is to be in joy. And therefore, it is written, serve the Creator with joy. If we relate to the Creator and the world created by Him with joy, with gratitude, without criticizing the Creator, we will feel that the world is really good. This means that we want to rise from the degree of Malkut to the degree of Bina, to faith, the degree of Bina, above reason, the degree of Malkut. The Creator treats me well, but it seems to me that I receive blows because instead of being in faith, the power of bestowal, I am in reception. It is I who corrupts His attitude toward me. Therefore, I must make every effort to reveal the goodness of the Creator. After all, there can be no evil in the world if there is no other force than the Creator, who is good and does good. If it seems to me that there is evil in the world, it is because I am corrupted inside. There is nothing else to fix except my attitude to reality. And then I will see that there is no evil, there is only good. From the Lesson for Women, November 1, 2020. A 10-cylinder engine. The revelation of the Creator comes from the lowest state, from the dust, as it is said, from dust you are and unto dust you shall return. We are falling into a state of dust all the time, losing all interest in spiritual desires and tastes. And from this dust, we must rise. They helped everyone his friend. A man by himself cannot rise from the descent but only if others set an example and awaken him. Then it will be a correct ascent and not because of egoism. A friend helps me rise, and I help a friend, that is, I work in a group, and forces of connection work here. Only then will it be a spiritual action. If a person has fallen into the state of dust, then he himself has no strength. The only hope is the 10. I will never be able to find the strength in me to move. The ego is trying to deceive me, try, and you will succeed. But this only works in our world and not in the spiritual world. I can only rise though with the strength of the group, they helped everyone his friend. Otherwise, it will not be an ascent but self-deception. I am at the bottom, my friends are at the top, and so we lift each other up like mountain climbers tied together with a rope. I annul myself before the 10, tried to feel less than everyone else, and due to this, I get strength from it. And then with these powers received from my friends, I do the reverse action and help them. By annulling myself in front of the group, I receive from it a higher power that acts on me and awakens me. I was lower than everyone else, but now with the power received from the group, I influence everyone else, that is, I become like the Creator for them. First I received it from my friends as Malkut, and now I give to them as Keter. So I am working like a piston engine, Malkut, Keter, Keter, Malkut. Everyone should be both the smallest and the greatest in the 10. If each one in the 10 works like this, then we will have an engine with 10 cylinders. Imagine, what a power! All the pistons together pump up our total volume until the measure overflows and the Creator is revealed inside. On the first stroke of the piston, I sink into the 10 and draw from it the desires of my friends, and on the second stroke, I raise these desires to the Creator. This ascent is called man because I ask for everyone, and I receive power from above. And with this power, I go down and pass it on to my friends, get a new desire from them again and raise it as a prayer, man. So I go up and down all the time, man, mad. And so does everyone in the group, all of our 10 cylinders. I connect to their desire and I want to raise my friends and bring them closer to the Creator. And from the Creator, I receive a gift of strength, fulfillment, and revelation, and pass it on to my friends. I work as a transmission channel in both directions as I want to raise the whole group to the Creator. From the second part of the Daily Kabbalah lesson, November 17, 2020, Work with Faith Above Reason. The Generation of Correction. There is a reliable remedy for the virus, connection. It is a lifesaver from all problems because we become similar to nature, which is absolutely global and integral. If we connect in this way, we become more connected to the common force of nature, which will correctly adjust all the systems of our life. There is a general law in nature that controls all of us. In order to get closer to this law and enter into correct interaction with it, we must connect. Just as the inanimate matter, plants, and animals connect into one symbiosis, so people must connect as well. Then why do we see that in nature one devours the other? It is because we, humans, treat each other egoistically, and our egoism affects all other levels of nature, inanimate, vegetative, and animate. If we correct our egoistic desire, the wolf would live peacefully next to the lamb, and no one in nature would attack the other. It is obvious to everyone that we will benefit from being in harmony with nature. In our generation, this harmony must be achieved by all of humanity, and it is therefore called the Generation of Correction. From the third part of the Daily Kabbalah lesson, November 15, 2020, The Last Generation. The Joy of the Commandment. A commandment is an opportunity to do something to please the Creator. And the more difficult the condition, which is not felt in my egoism as pleasant, the better. After all, this means that I do not have an egoistic motivation in this action but act against my egoism. Then it is really called a commandment, that is, I carry out the Creator's instruction to draw closer to Him despite the resistance of my egoism. The joy of the commandment is that I can take action against my desire to enjoy more and more each time. It may be a small achievement, but the main thing is that it should be about unification. All I need is connection with friends and the daily lesson. These are two tools for getting closer to the Creator. If I fulfill both the first and the second condition every day, then the day was not wasted. This is how you need to consider your life, and then it will flow meaningfully and bring a special result. From the first part of the Daily Kabbalah lesson, November 17, 2020, Work with Faith Above Reason. My new article on LinkedIn, Debunking the Myth, Evil Eyes, Evil Will. One of the most common misconceptions about the wisdom of Kabbalah is that it can protect against evil eye. Kabbalah can indeed protect against evil eye, but the problem is that people have misconceptions about the meaning of the term evil eye. However, Kabbalah doesn't speak of the correction of only one person. Its final aim is to transform all of humanity by changing our evil thoughts of each other into good thoughts. This transformation of thoughts is the only way we can improve the deteriorating state of our world. It is also the only protection we can have from the evil eye, which is, as just said, our own nature. According to Encyclopedia Britannica, and other sources that echo the same idea, evil eye is a glance believed to have the ability to cause injury or death to those on whom it falls. I have seen advertisements for amulets that are presented as related to the wisdom of Kabbalah, and can purportedly protect against such glares. I wish things were so simple that I could pay a few dollars and protect myself from curses. According to the wisdom of Kabbalah, it is not our eyes that are evil, but our entire being, our hearts, as in, the inclination of a man's heart is evil from his youth, Gen 8:21. We, all the people, are born with what is called desire to receive only for ourselves. We may or may not help other people, we may or may not be kind to other people, we may or may not be tough or soft, caring or cold, rude or polite, but in the end, we will be thinking of our own benefit when we do whatever we do, and we'll be doing it for our own benefit. This is why, despite countless good deeds that people do, the world is still going from bad to worse and nothing seems to help despite all our efforts. Looking at, or even thinking of another person with the intention to benefit from that person, rather than the intention to benefit that person, is the Kabbalistic definition of evil eye. In fact, the whole purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah is to change our intention from benefiting ourselves, namely having an evil eye, to benefiting others, namely to acquire a good eye. However, Kabbalah doesn't speak of the correction of only one person. Its final aim is to transform all of humanity by changing our evil thoughts of each other into good thoughts. This transformation of thoughts is the only way we can improve the deteriorating state of our world. It is also the only protection we can have from the evil eye, which is, as just said, our own nature. My article in Newsmax, "The Pandemic Antisemites Call Israel." People react to what hurts them the most and antisemites are no exception. A global response to the coronavirus pandemic, which continues to wreak havoc with more than 50 million cases worldwide, apparently is not the priority for the UN's World Health Organization, WHO. Instead of assessing a global response to the problem, it spent 4 valuable hours of its General Assembly bashing its annoyance, Israel. A similar dose of hatred has been injected by anti-Semites who are accusing Jews behind the companies in charge of the new COVID-19 vaccines of trying to control the world and profit from the pandemic. More than 1 million people have died from COVID-19 around the planet. After months of the pandemic, the virus continues to spread uncontrollably. Lockdowns have been renewed in multiple cities around the world, the global economy crumbles, the education systems operate irregularly and every realm of people's lives has been impacted. So how is it possible that the main concern of WHO's member nations was condemning the Jewish nation for the health conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and in the occupied Syrian Golan? If they were to search for real facts concerning those portrayed as underserved in healthcare services, they would discover that in fact the alleged victims receive better medical care in Israel than in any Arab country. So, is there any logic behind singling out Israel over and over again? There is none, because antisemitism is an irrational sentiment. Conspiracy theories and blood libels against Jews are not new, they are just reignited. The fact that the scientific community has worked around the clock to develop a new vaccine against the deadly virus has only fueled anti-Semitic allegations. The top medical expert of Moderna, the pharmaceutical company behind just one of the new COVID-19 vaccines, is Dr. Tal Zaks, an Israeli scientist, and Dr. Albert Bourla, a Jew of Greek descent and CEO of Pfizer, which is responsible for another vaccine against the coronavirus. In Greece, a newspaper published a series of articles accusing Dr. Bourla of Nazi-like intentions behind the scientific discovery and of making millions of dollars from the pandemic in coordination with Israel. The world has a disease, antisemitism, that particularly resurfaces in times of peril. Why is this so? It is because people feel that Jews hold a pivotal quality to solve the world's troubles. By attacking Jews, they in fact raise the Jewish nation to the pinnacle, holding them both responsible for the problems and, at the same time, acknowledging them as those able and empowered to repair an aching planet. It is precisely the role of the Jewish nation, founded upon the tenet of love your neighbor as yourself, to lead the way to the attainment of unity and toward recovery of the balance in nature that has been lost as a result of our unruly, egoistic and self-centered human relations. Since the times of Abraham, Jews were the first people to identify and understand the laws of nature, the need to live in a society based on mutual responsibility. As nature tightens humanity's connection and more hatred surfaces between people, the time is ripe for learning how to realize our increasing connection positively, how to unite above the growing separation. In the last few months, the need for unity has become pronounced. The coronavirus pandemic illustrates the need for mutual responsibility and consideration to restore and maintain good health, and growing social divisiveness demonstrates the need for unity. If we fail to progress to unity above our own differences as a Jewish nation, we will continue evoking hatred upon ourselves, and people will increasingly accuse us of being the root of the world's problems, as we now also see with the coronavirus. The sooner we realize that our unity will have a positive rippling effect the world over, the sooner we will realize that we are treating antisemitism at its root. By uniting, we fulfill our role in the world of bringing the forces between humanity and nature back to balance. If we realize our role and initiate unity between us, we will not only see antisemitism diminish, but also, conversely, we can expect love and respect for a Jewish people who radiate a positive unifying example to the world. Then there would be no reason for anyone to hate Jews, because people would know how to unite. And united people do not hate each other or the ones who show the way to their unity as the only cure to humanity's pains. The Times of Israel published my new article on Jewish unity and antisemitism, article number 2. In the previous article, we described Abraham's struggle to spread his revelation that there is only one force in reality, which he called God, that force manifested into ways, giving and receiving, and everything, in reality, reflected interactions between the two. We also said that Abraham realized that his contemporaries in Babylon, his homeland, were becoming alienated from each other. Abraham wished to counter that alienation with kindness and mercy in order to balance the growing force of reception with appropriate giving. When his efforts were turned down and he was expelled from Babylon, he wandered west to Canaan. Along the way, thousands and tens of thousands, according to Maimonides, Midrash Rabbah, and many other sources, joined him and became the house of Abraham. Those people formed the nucleus from which the Israeli nation would later rise. The special thing about them was that they had nothing biological in common, but rather the conviction that receiving must be balanced with giving, and they were willing to toil in order to develop the quality of mercy within them. This article will review Israel's time in Egypt. By and large, we are taught that Israel's time in Egypt was a nightmare, that they were enslaved and tormented there until they had no choice but to escape in the dead of night. Yet, this is a very incomplete representation of the picture. The book of Genesis, from chapter 47 and into the book of Exodus, tells us that when Israel went into Egypt, Joseph was already Pharaoh's viceroy and his most trusted man. Pharaoh even gave him his signet to use as he pleased. When Joseph's family sought shelter in Egypt, Pharaoh gave them the most fertile land in the country, the land of Goshen, in the eastern delta of the Nile. Joseph placed his family members in key positions and they prospered under his protection. As long as they were united under Joseph, things went smoothly for them and they were successful, prosperous, and multiplied. However, when Joseph died, the Israelites' unity began to weaken. Consequently, everything changed. The Israelites began to conceal their Jewishness, writes Professor Vaishiman of Bar Ilan University in Israel. They were immersed in Egyptian culture, enthusiastically attending Egyptian cultural events and adopting their modes of entertainment. Egyptian sports and theater were popular pastimes amongst the new Jewish immigrants. Little by little, they abandoned their commitment to unity and immersed themselves in self-indulgence and narcissism. That, perhaps, was the first incident of disunity that leads to Jew hatred, long before the terms had been invented. Much to the Israelites' regret, the more they wanted to assimilate in Egypt, the more Pharaoh and all of Egypt turned against them. The Book of Zohar, Shemot, asks, why were Israel exiled, and why specifically to Egypt? The answer that the Zohar gives is that they were exiled to Egypt because the Egyptians were proud and despised and loathed Israel, and therefore did not want the Hebrews to mingle with them. Midrash Rabbah, Shemot 1:8, adds a more explicit version of the story, pointing the finger directly at the Jews. When Joseph died, they broke the covenant and said, "Let us be as the Egyptians." Because of it, the Lord turned the love that the Egyptians loved them into hatred. In other words, Pharaoh and the Egyptians didn't turn against Israel simply because they were bad people, but because they abandoned the legacy of unity and strove to mingle with Egypt and disunite from one another. This is why the Torah writes that only after Joseph died, Pharaoh turned against the Hebrews. Once Pharaoh became anti-Semitic, if you will, the Hebrews had no choice but to reunite. This pattern, where Jews shun unity when they are prosperous and are forced into it by the persecution of a local leader, would repeat itself from Egypt to this day. These days, we are seeing the end of the same cycle in America. Jews have been prosperous for several decades, achieved material wealth and power, but have abandoned their unity. Now we are seeing the flipping of the country from appreciation and approval to denunciation, criticism, and eventually hate. In the next article, we will review Moses' efforts to reunite the tormented people and thereby redeem them from their oppressors. For much more on this topic, please see my latest publication, The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism, Historical Facts on Anti-Semitism as a Reflection of Jewish Social Discord. Michael Leitman, on Quora, what is equality? Equality takes place when we all fully invest ourselves into the creation of an integral society. In the ensuing integral inclusion of all people, we become conditionally equal. In such equality, we will receive and give as much as it is possible for each one of us, individually to do so. It is impossible to measure every individual and determine the amount that they owe and need for themselves. If we, however, connect in a way that motivates us all to build an integral society, then we will reach this conditional form of equality. Such equality is conditional because no two people are equal to each other by nature. If we were equal by nature, then we would already experience oneness. Equality thus lets each of us express ourselves individually as maximally as possible, while participating in a common collective action. Medium published my new article commemorating the International Men's Day, Has Manhood Become Obsolete? In the past, men were the breadwinners, and often the sole providers. In the 20th century, and particularly after World War II, things began to change, and today there is much more equality between men and women, at least as far as being the breadwinner goes. The trajectory was leaning toward even more equality, but then COVID broke into our lives and tossed everything into a muddled heap. With offices closing left and right, and people working more and more from home, or losing their jobs altogether, humanity seems poised to embark on the next social revolution, a transition to spiritual connections. Instead of fighting, men's work will be more around engagement with each other, meaning forming positive connections rather than combative and competitive relations. Along with the growing equality, it's become apparent that men aren't sure about their role in the family, in relations with partners, and often in life. Women, too, became unsure about the role that men should play in their lives. Men don't need to hunt anymore, not even metaphorically, meaning provide for the family, and they can't really protect their families from the storms of the outside world, which has become not only hostile, but also too complicated to handle. So, if men can't provide sustenance or protection, does the world really need them? It does, because when material needs are provided, Spiritual needs come into play and demand their satisfaction no less than material needs. And when it comes to spiritual matters, each sex has its unique role that only it can do. And because both are required to make society complete in the spiritual sense, men and women are becoming equally important, complete opposites, yet complementary and indispensable. Instead of fighting, men's work will be more around engagement with each other, meaning forming positive connections rather than combative and competitive relations. Also, in light of the situation, and in light of the fact that schooling will be done much more at home, men will have to become more active at home, and particularly when it comes to education, both in terms of teaching values, as well as in provision of knowledge and teaching school topics. When we speak of spirituality, we often imagine yoga postures, meditations, and things of that nature. I am not speaking about that. I am referring more to the spirit of society, the atmosphere in society. Of course, both men and women will play their vital parts in nurturing the spirit of society, but men, who were used to competing with one another, will now have to transform their thinking and learn to support one another in order to bolster the community. In the end, our happiness depends on the society we live in. If that society fosters solidarity and mutual responsibility, if people feel accountable to their society and wish to contribute to their communities, then people in that society, or community, will be happier, more stable emotionally, and more confident. Men will have to take an active role in that process, participate in their community's activities more than before, and be more involved. The era of measuring success by one's income or career achievements is quickly ending. We are embarking on a social era, where people are measured by their contribution to society. Especially now, when we see that the main thing that's broken in the country is the society, the ability to fashion solid communities and societies will become the hottest commodity. Accordingly, manhood has to adopt a whole new meaning, more social, collaborative, and uniting. Michael Leitman, on Quora, What Differs Freedom from Anarchy? When we gain a clear understanding and perception of nature's laws, then we see that everything in nature is predetermined, and that there is no anarchy in nature and in human behavior. Reaching this understanding requires aiming ourselves at becoming like nature, as human nature is completely self-serving and receives constantly into itself. Nature in and of itself is an opposite altruistic and all-giving quality. By aiming ourselves to become giving like nature, we attract nature's positive influence, and undergo various changes under its influence. When we discover and feel nature's force of bestowal within ourselves, we then become able to act by our own free choice and decide for ourselves what forces to activate, bestowal or reception. There is no anarchy in such a process. Nature functions according to absolute and rigid laws, and it does not accept anarchy. Models of behavior in society. Remark, there are several models of behavior in society that were described thousands of years ago. For example, some societies live by the law of what is mine, what is yours. This is peculiar to the American dream. My comment, this is considered the worst trait, the sodomite rule. There is nothing worse than this. This path is vicious, and the creator, nature, does not agree with it and destroys this movement. If Americans remain at the level of what is mine, what is yours, they will simply drive themselves to a dead end. Even the state of what is mine and what is mine, which is considered the condition of a criminal, is much better than this because it does not cancel communication between people. I take from you, you take from me, we are still in some kind of connection. There is also the state of what is yours and what is yours, which is the law of complete bestowal. This is the state of an absolute righteous who does everything for others. He is ready to be a member of a right society and sets a good example for others. This is what human society should come to in the future. From CapTV's Communication Skills, August 21, 2020. Blitz of Kabbalah Tips, July 2, 2020. Question: what prevents us from achieving the purpose of life? Answer: our egoism, whose main characteristic is laziness. Question: is it necessary to discuss the meaning of life and the purpose of life with other people? Answer: why shouldn't one? After all, our goal is one and in common, there is no secret in it. It should really be discussed everywhere and with everyone. Question: should each person's goal in life be personal or only collective? Answer: it is personal for the sake of being accommodated to the collective. Question: how much does my purpose depend on others in a society of those who are searching for it? Answer: we can and must help one another, otherwise we cannot advance quickly. Question: do you agree with the assertion, the meaning of life is to find the meaning of life? Answer: yes, I do. Question: what is your purpose in life and have you attained it? Answer: I am trying to attain it. Question: what are your plans for the coming year, for the coming month, and for today? Answer: I am trying to achieve the impossible so that it will be possible. From CapTV's Management Skills, July 2, 2020. Kabbalah and the Big Bang. Question: I recently learned about the science of Kabbalah, and it seems to me that it does not answer the question of the beginning of creation. You often mention the Big Bang theory, thus supporting the teachings of godless materialistic scientists. And Kabbalah says that God exists. Based on this logic, it turns out that an aircraft can be produced by blowing up an aircraft factory? Answer: you are a little confused. First, the Big Bang that took place at the beginning of creation and which is described in the wisdom of Kabbalah is not something that actually existed and later exploded and ceased to exist. It is the penetration of upper energy into the lowest level, the level of our world, and the beginning of its spreading. Before that, there was no time, motion, or space. One microscopic spark of the upper light that materialized in our world generated a space in which our universe and everything that is in it exists, starting from hydrogen, helium, and all the other elements. Second, the wisdom of Kabbalah tells us how this energy descended through the five upper worlds, from the world of Ein Sof to the last spiritual world called the world of Asiya, and then crossed that barrier between the spiritual world and our world and gave birth to everything that is in it. All this is studied in the science of Kabbalah. From CapTV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, November 11, 2018. The influence of negative intentions on nature. Remark: according to Baal HaSulam, the specificity of the law of bestowal to society is such that, unlike the law of receiving, negative feedback not only does not come immediately, and does not affect us, directly, but indirectly. My comment: in the material world, I see that the more I get, the better it is for me. But it is absolutely not clear if it will be better for me if I would give more. On the contrary, it seems to me that it will be worse. That is why, in our world, the law works only one way, toward receiving. Remark: if I think about society, bestow to people, care about them, then I do not see any benefit from this for myself and, obviously, no encouragement from society. Therefore, as Baal HaSulam writes, as a result of the violation of these two laws, humanity is subject to destruction, both from the inside and outside, hunger, cataclysms, crises, viruses, etc. My comment: the thing is, we humans are above all other levels of nature and our negative intentions influence biological, physical, and other phenomena. In such a way, we affect nature and it becomes aggressive in all its parts, elements, laws, and manifestations. This is what we see in our life, in our world. But we do not understand our connection with nature, and thus prompted to such rough, incorrect interactions. We break good ties in nature and instead force it to act incorrectly, not in integral correspondence between its parts, in wrong communication. From CapTV's Communication Skills, August 21, 2020. New Life 451. The Jews in the Diaspora.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on the New Life Show, a series of talks with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Yael Shadarel. Hello. Today we'd like to talk about Jews in the diaspora. Many Jewish people live outside of Israel, and we'd like to understand this phenomena, and what do we feel as people that live here in Israel towards them? Yael, please. Yeah. In the world, there are about 14.5 million Jews. A bit more than 6 million live here in Israel. A bit less live in the United States. And the rest are dispersed around the world in different Jewish communities. We feel that they're a part of us. We feel that all of us are connected in some way. Judaism sees the Jews in the diaspora as partners in the establishment of the State of Israel, even though that they don't live here. On the one hand, we're very close to them. On the other hand, mentally, we're very different. And we'd like to understand on this show, who are the Jews of the diaspora? What's the connection between us? We feel that we have to protect them to some extent. They feel that they have to protect us to some extent. We both keep our homeland. There's some kind of a connection here that we'd like to understand. And what is our role towards them? What is their role towards us? And especially at the end of the day, how do we build the right kind of connection between us? And I'd maybe like to start with the difference between those that immigrate from Israel and the Jews in the diaspora. The Jews that immigrate from Israel, we know them, we went together to the army, to the university, and one day they get up, pack their things, and leave. But we don't really know who the Jews in the diaspora are. I have this distant memory. When I was about 12, I went with my parents to the United States. My aunt lived there, and her husband had a big Jewish family there. And this was my first meeting with the Jews of the United States, and I felt a very big difference between how we lived here in Israel, how they lived there. We thought differently. There was a girl there my age. We could barely communicate, but there was some kind of a connection. We celebrated the same holidays, family meals, so there was something that connected us, but also something that really distanced us from one another. So what's the difference between those that immigrate from Israel and the Jews that live in the diaspora? How would you characterize the Jews in the diaspora? I relate to all these things a bit differently than you do. You're starting with what's the difference between these and those and what's the connection and so on. Meaning, on the social level, on the human level, even on the personal and family level, I'm not looking at that. What I see is there's this kind of animal in front of me, called a human being. This animal is operated by nature, A, and B, by the environment. Two factors that operate, activate a person, nature and the environment. A person's nature is the will to enjoy. everything, including everything. Where here you have the matter of a habit, which becomes a second nature, meaning it's possible that I enjoy very strange things that an ordinary person wouldn't think of, and I became accustomed to, and maybe to someone from the outside it seems that I'm suffering, but I need these things that seem as suffering because I'm used to them. It also happens this way. And therefore, when I look at a person, first of all, I look at two things. Is the will to receive? There's nothing to say about that. That's obvious. He has different habits that also became a second nature, and I have to study these habits. And besides the habits, there's the environment that influences a person. If I'm here, I live here in Israel, and it's the atmosphere here in Israel, that there is a lot of pressure, different kinds of pressure. There's also something that pressures me, but differently. If here it comes from these directions, then there it comes from those directions, the opposite. So you can't compare a person that lives here with a person that lives there. They don't understand each other. They can talk about how do the kids get along, about health, because we're talking on the animate level. But a bit more than that, these are different concepts, different values, desires, yearnings, relations, and so on. Where else can we feel that we're alike, that we're connected? Around the holidays, traditional food on Saturdays, or something that our grandma used to make, which is a habit. They have the same habit, we have the same habit, and so we can talk about these mutual points. But there aren't many of them. My relations with the environment and their relations with the environment, which is the main thing, are different. Can you define the difference between the two? That over time, we lose our connection to the point where soon we'll see no connection between the Jews that live here and Jews that live in the diaspora, that they're the part of the same nation or something. Because the religious connection in most cases disappeared already, meaning that they become less and less religious. Yeah, so the religious connection is gone, so we can't meet in the synagogue. We don't have something mutual. We don't have the habits and the rules of the Shabbat. Our sons won't go to the same yeshiva and so on. But we're reaching a state where a person can barely remember that he's Jewish if he's living overseas, abroad. I met many such people. I remember I talked to the chief psychologist of New York, a young fellow who was maybe 45, and we're talking and everything, and I called Chaim Ratz, my interpreter. Chaim, come here a second, I want to ask you something. And he says, Chaim, that's my middle name. He has a few names. So his middle name is also Chaim. He doesn't look like a Jew or anything. He says, I'm also Chaim. He remembered. And that's how it is. Also, his wife later came. She was Asian. So what I want to say is that if in the past we were connected through religion, today no more. If we're connected because we have mutual enemies, then it's possible, but today it relatively no longer exists, and nowadays a Jew can hide that he's Jewish. Even though that we know that it's a problem and you can't hide forever. Therefore, a Jew or Jews in the diaspora I'd say that they mingle with special audiences. They have their circles with the nations of the world that they mingle with, and besides that, also the circles of the Jews that they mingle with. They want to keep their identity to some extent. They want to get married somehow amongst themselves in order to influence the children. I also lived for 30-something years among the nations of the world. I know this mentality. And later on I saw it also in France and in the United States. It's the same mentality. It's a wonder. Jews from the United States and Russia and England and France, there's something similar about the Jews. What's similar? It's something that they can't completely conceal or get rid of. It's a kind of a special attitude towards the family, the children. A special care for them. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's a special care for the family and children. Why is this a common Jewish denominator? That because it has to do with the Jewish character that comes from spirituality, that they're concerned with their root, with their future root, that they feel subconsciously, so they care for the continuity of the generation. The connection between the parents and the children and the grandchildren is much deeper and stronger than among the nations of the world. And as a society, times are changing so quickly now, taking on multifaceted different forms, shapes, even counter ones. So I can't say that there is a clear tendency here. But in part of the cases, Jews do everything that they can in order to conceal their Jewishness, and in part of the cases they won't do it, and then they move from place to place, change something, but nonetheless in order to remain Jewish. Jews in the diaspora, also today I can't exactly say the Jews of the diaspora, that suddenly there are thousands of people that move from France to Israel, and thousands of people from France move to the United States, or Jews from Russia go to live in the United States or in Israel. It's, you know, everything's on the move, kind of. And therefore, there's no such real concept as the Jews of the diaspora. But they're in between states. It's a liquid state. I'd say that we can correct all of this, that eventually, first of all, we have to reach all the Jews, as Baal Sulam writes in the introduction to the Book of Zohar, and we have to explain what their destiny is and how can we reach it. Do you think that Jews and the diaspora, individual Jews, Jewish communities, have a role? And if so, what is it? Yes, they have a role. I'd say that they have the same role as ours, those who live here in Israel. which is what? To be light unto the nations. They have no role towards themselves. This is what I want to say, first of all. The Jewish nation did not, does not, and will not exist for itself. It is a nation that comes to serve the nations of the world. How? By showing them the plan of creation, the direction, the goal, and to accompany them towards it. The goal being what? The revelation of the Creator. The Creator being what? The force of love and bestowal. For it to appear among all the nations. The people of Israel have to bring the world to this state. As the shepherds, they have to take this flock, which is all of humanity, and bring them to the state of revelation of love and bestowal among everyone. Yes. And until then, everyone will hate them because they're functioning incorrectly regarding what they're expected to do. So, their role of instilling love and bestowal to the nations, you regarded as being light onto the nations.
Yeah.
And you're saying that there's no difference between the Jews that live in Israel and those that live abroad, and that their role is to bring love and bestowal to all people. Yeah. But still we see that there are Jews that live in Israel and outside of Israel. Jews that live outside of Israel. They probably have some kind of role, right? Suppose we're both Jews, right? I'm an Israeli, and he lives in the United States. We're both Jews, yes. We both have to be light onto the nations, yes. We both have to introduce love and bestowal to the world, yes. But still, he lives there, and I live here. Does he have a certain role towards me here, towards Israel? A mutual role, to be connected with all the Jews around the world as much as possible in order for us to have the correct force in order to bestow upon the nations of the world and bring them to adhesion with the Creator. We're shepherds. Imagine you have 7 billion sheep. 7 billion. And you, meaning the nation, the people of Israel, have to take these sheep and bring them to the goal, lead them there. This is your role. And until you take the rope and start bringing them to the goal, they'll hate you, and they'll say that you're out of place, you're not doing what you should be doing, and you're harming them. Okay, that goes for all Jews in the world. Right. Let's focus on Jews that live in the diaspora. How are they related to this? This is something that all Jews have to do? Yes. Now, a Jew that lives outside of Israel, what's the emphasis there? He's not living in Israel. Doesn't matter. He has to know the plan, study the plan, he has to be connected with the rest of the Jews, and from this connection with the rest of the Jews, they have to become one head. Israel means Lirosh, meaning I have a head. And then the Jews that are connected all around the world that are called Israel have to connect the body called the nations of the world to this head and bring this general entity, which is the head being Israel and the nations being the body, to adhesion with the Creator. So maybe it's good that the Jews are dispersed all around the world because there is this Jewish network all around the world that can perform their role. And it's much easier to perform the role towards the nations when you're a part of them, when you live among them, than when you're disconnected and you live here. You're saying that living in Israel, we have so many problems that they disconnect us from the main thing that we have to do, which is tend for the nations of the world. I'm saying that maybe the Jews in the diaspora, they also have a role, that they're dispersed this way on purpose. Right. It's not necessarily that a Jew that lives here in Israel, he is the fittest for the correction of the world. A Jew wherever he is, he also has to carry out the very same role. Okay, Jews around the world hear what you're saying now. First of all, they have to belong to our organization, because besides our organization, no other organization talks about it or cares for it. But we're the ones that have to arrange it. And a Jew is he who joins us. And then when that person is drawn to connection and to connect the entire world with the upper force, with the Creator, then he's called a Jew, and then he comes to that. And there will be those from the nations of the world that will come and join this very task, and they will also be called Jews in Israel. And what does it say about the connection that we have to establish between Israel and... Let's put it differently. Today, we feel committed towards the Jews in the diaspora, and the Jews in the diaspora feel committed to the land of Israel. Unless we're talking about our destiny, about the final goal and its realization, then what are we talking about? Because we had mutual forefathers. Because once we had some common grandmother. What are we talking about here? So yeah, the French all around the world care for France, that if something happens in France, then they're related to it. But that's on the corporeal level, on the animate level. Here we're talking about a spiritual goal that we yet have to realize, and it connects us in a completely different way. It's not in memory of Abraham, our patriarch, but it's for the sake of the future, for carrying out our role. The Creator is forcing us. We're obligated to the nations of the world. We're connected to them, to Him. We're the transition in between the two. That's the connection. Meaning that there is work ahead of us. It's not for the sake of the past, that we used to dance the same dances, and we had the same folk music, and we ate the same food on Sabbath. And even now that it no longer exists, it somehow reminds us about where we came from. Incorrect. That's something that we have to do in the future. And it's not like brothers that meet after 50 years, and then they recall how it was at mom's place. It's not meant for that. It's in order to reach a connection for the sake of the future, for a future role. If I understand what you're saying, then regardless where you are, if you're a Jew, what connects you to the rest of the Jews of the world is some future state that you have to reach. What is that state? Every Jew in the world will have to connect with the rest of the Jews, either in a good and nice way out of his own free choice, or under the blows, in order to realize his role together with them, being the shepherd for all of humanity. To lead humanity where? To lead humanity to contact and adhesion with the Creator. Can you explain that? The Creator meaning where everyone's connected by ties of mutual love. What do you mean by everyone? Everyone, including everyone. All the Jews, all the nations of the world, all the people, all the people. The Jews exist only in order to realize this role. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist. What's the connection between the mutual love between people and connection with the Creator? It's one and the same. Meaning, the Creator is a quality that becomes revealed in the connection between people. That's why it's called Bore, Creator. In Hebrew, coming from the words Bo'u'e, come and see. So the future state of Jews is that they're all interconnected regardless of where they live, and then they realize their role, which is to instill mutual love among all people, to the point that the upper force is revealed among them. The upper force being what? The Creator. there. And what is this force by essence? The force of the stolen love. Okay, so now this is the common future of all Jews. Not the common future, but the role of all Jews towards the rest of humanity. Yeah. Regardless whether they understand or don't, they live or don't live in Israel, this is the future state. Yes. Okay, so what we have now is Jews that live in Israel, and we have Jews that live abroad. Now, regarding that future picture, that future role, what should be the relationship between the Jews that live in Israel and the Jews that live abroad in the diaspora? First of all, the Jews here in Israel, because they live in a small place, under threat, under pressure, and so on, they are more ready for connection. And therefore, we, as the organization that is working within the land of Israel, and this is why we're here, in the land of Israel and not in Switzerland or some other place, first of all, we have to work towards the Jews that live here in Israel. This is regarding the Bnei Baruch organization. Yes. Now, in addition to that, we also have to work with the Jews overseas and to publicize among them the knowledge of the future picture that you depicted. Yes. And about our role, that we have to connect in order to become the shepherd to those sheep. And then they won't shout at us that we're causing harm in the world because we'll lead them to good. And then what kind of relationship will there be between the Jews in the diaspora and the Jews here in Israel? They'll all come here? No, no, not at all. The land of Israel will spread to the entire world. What kind of relations will there be between the Jews in the diaspora and the Jews in Israel? Everyone is working to bring humanity to connection with the Creator. I don't exactly understand. We, as an organization, are activating all the Jews all over the world, meaning we activate them in order for them to connect, to unite. And from within the connection between all of the Jews of the world, we lead the process. And from this connection, we instill the integral education to the rest of humanity, and by this build a network of connection, bestowal, and love, in which the Creator becomes revealed, and we reach the general and final correction, which is what? The force of love and bestowal that is disclosed to everyone, tying everyone together to become as one man in one heart, and the Creator together with us, and then the world reaches a state where Israel, Oraita, and Kuchabrichu are one, meaning Israel, the Torah, and the Creator are one, because everyone reaches the degree of Israel and the Torah, which is the upper light, the force of love and bestowal that becomes revealed, and the Creator dwells within it. Again, what is the final correct state? All of us. All the Jewish people. All the people in the world become as one desire. And as a result of all of these small desires starting to connect in mutual love, it all turns into one big desire of bestowal and love, in which the upper light called the Creator is revealed, and then He and His name are one. The desire and the light are as one. And by that, the world will reach the desired correction. Thank you very much, Dr. Lightman. Thank you, Yael. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.